constructive conflict. Is there such a thing? Well, conflict, we've all experienced it, whether it be the barbed comments, nasty gossip, hurt feelings, maybe even by email. You know, you get those emails and they're all capital letters, like they're shouting at you. Maybe extended episodes of the silent treatment or screaming matches. One writer described all of these as the greatest hits of bad conflict resolution. As long as people live and work together, conflicts are bound to happen, as we see in the Herman cartoon. Is this going to work for us? No? Okay, well, it was going to be a Herman cartoon, and his wife had just given him a big spoonful of medicine. And just after he'd swallowed it, she said, "Oops, I'm supposed to rub it on your chest." Now, conflicts are going to arise. Most of us feel that we could live without tension and conflict. After all, it can do bad things to us and can cause us to do bad things to others. It can wear us out emotionally and physically and can cause us to wear out the people who are most important to us because we keep repeating the agenda that bothers us, stirring up the same old issue. Some people verbalize it outwardly, others have it running internally. When we carry on the debate with ourselves, it wears us down and we can become depressed, which is bad news for us. Or we become angry and reactive. Oh, not yet. Which is usually bad news for everybody else. Different people react differently to tension. Some become hyper and get so wound up that they can't stop themselves from talking about the thing that made them angry. Other people become exhausted, feel tired and defeated, and just internalize. As Roy Bell, in his book, Biblical Models of Handling Conflict, notes, tension can affect us spiritually too, because all of our energy goes into the issue in which we are involved. When all our energy goes to such tense issues, our spiritual resources are depleted, spent, wasted, and gone. So naturally, most of us feel that we could do without conflict. Yet, conflicts are a normal part of life. In fact, positively speaking, they can help us to expose and to address needed changes. Think about Jesus going into the temple and clearing out the money changers. Because the place of prayer, how could it be a place of prayer when all of the place and space was taken up by a huge market and animals? How could the people pray, especially the Gentiles in that setting? So how we handle conflict matters, and it matters a lot. And so now the cartoon, right on time there. Perhaps you're like the gentleman here sitting at the table. I am very angry. What do you suggest? Well, that's what we're going to look at. Okay. In his letter to the Ephesians, and I invite you to turn to the letter to the Ephesians in the New Testament, Paul gives specific concrete counsel on how to handle potentially destructive emotions like anger constructively. And so we're going to look at Ephesians chapter 4. I'm going to read beginning at verse 25, which is what we looked at last week, but I want to pick it up from there, all the way to chapter 5, verse 2, because some of them just kind of flows over. So Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbor, for we were all members of one body. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Those who have been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with their own hands, that they may have something to share with those in need. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Get rid of all bitterness, rage, and anger, brawling, and slander, along with every form of malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other just as in Christ God forgave you. Follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. I want to begin with a few general observations before we dig into the details on a few verses. First, did you notice that Paul balances each negative prohibition with a corresponding positive command? For example, he's put off the destructive vices, like put off your old self, he said, and put on the new self. And he urges his readers not only to give up lying and stealing and losing their temper, but they are also then to speak the truth, to work hard, and to be kind to others. Each command is also accompanied by a motivating clause. This is why you should do it. The reason we are to put off the old self and put on the new self that is being recreated by God. We saw this last week as well in James. When we listened to James's counsel for constructive communication, remember, there was this natural bent to be quick to speak, quick to anger, and slow to listen. And James says, no, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. You see, there are destructive thoughts and feelings and actions that we need to resist. And there are constructive thoughts, feelings, and promptings of the Spirit that need to be released. And the motivating clause, the rationale for the benefits, comes down to basically two things. First, he says in verse 25, for we are all members of one body. So live like that. It's not an us and them mentality, it's an us mentality. That they may have something to share with those in need, Paul will say, that it may benefit those who listen, he will say of words. And then a second thing, just as in Christ God forgave you. He's like, this should not be foreign to your experience. In fact, this is central to your experience of what you have experienced. Now, work that out in your living. Just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us. Just as Christ. This is why Paul will introduce the specific instructions he does. If we look back at actually in verse 17 of chapter 4, he will say, so I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do. That is, put off your old self. It's like an old pair of dirty clothes. It's like, get rid of that. And you must put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. For you gardeners, this is about weeding and feeding. Okay? And so let's get into the specifics of how to deal with our destructive tendencies and our anger. So back to our cartoon person there. I'm very angry. What do you suggest? Well, I've chosen to focus on verses 26 and 27 because as authors Glenn Taylor and Rod Wilson note in their book, Exploring Your Anger, these two verses provide the touchstone for all the biblical material on anger, they say. If you only can look at two verses, these are the ones. First, let's look at. First, we need to think about anger. Is all anger sinful? Well, first, what is anger? It's important to just draw a distinction between our experience of anger and the expression of anger, which is exactly what Paul does. In your anger, right, do not sin. So distinguish between the experience and expression. There's actually four words for anger in the Greek. Three are used within this passage itself. Orge, the first one, in your anger. And then another one, at the second half, in your anger, it's a different word. It's actually kind of in your exasperation. So it's kind of like a more intense anger, if you will. And then in verse 31, he will say, put away all, one of the words we translated as rage, another word for anger. So there's certain aspects that should be absolutely done away with, others that need to be channeled. The opening phrase actually consists of two imperatives. It's literally, be angry and don't sin. And translators and commentators have puzzled over why two imperatives. In your anger, but do not be angry, but don't sin. It could be understanding the first imperative as a conditional or a concession. That is, if, you know, although you get angry, make sure you don't sin. In this case, he would be kind of permitting and restricting rather than, you know, commanding them to be angry. And yet it is possible that the use of the imperative not merely permits experiences of anger, but presumes that some experiences of anger will be right. That is, be angry if you are angry at the right things and in the right way and at the right time, and don't sin. When we think about Jesus' experiences and expressions of anger, of course, when Jesus cleared the temple in John chapter 2, my house will be a house of prayer, and he was consumed with zeal for the Lord's house. There's other examples in Mark chapter 3, verse 5, when he was angry at the attitude of the Pharisees and the religious teachers who were trying to prevent him from healing a person on the Sabbath. And when the little children are waiting in the wings to come to him, and the disciples are saying, no, guys, you're not important enough, it says he was indignant. And he says, let the little children come to me. So there's appropriate expressions of anger. So anger, just a good working definition, anger is an experience that occurs when a goal, a value, or expectation that I have chosen has been blocked or my sense of personal worth is threatened. So when Jesus came to the temple, he expected the court of the Gentiles to be clear and in an appropriate setting for Gentiles who wanted to come and pray to God to do so. And when it wasn't, there was a, you know, he was angry. Well, anger is a feeling, an emotion common to us all, but what triggers our anger and the intensity level of it is uniquely tied to our personal goals, values, or expectations. For example, you may come to worship and you may say, could you believe what that worship leader was wearing up there, or the pastor? You know, all pastors should have a suit and tie, and, you know, he's just got like a shirt on. And the next person, you know, thinks, that's great. I hate it when somebody's wearing a tie. You know, it looks so stuffy. And then another person is like, who cares? Like, just get on with it, right? Same experience, but we respond differently. And so it's important to realize that our anger is tied to our goals, our values, our expectations. And those have been wired into us, and we wire them into us. Sometimes through our personal heritage, through our own history, through our values. You know, drums in worship. I'm old enough to remember when there was no drums in the worship service. And when drums came in, there was, you know, it ranged from great, finally, to that's awful, I'm ready to leave. Okay? Because feelings, thinking will vary from person to person. And we can expect that what triggers our experience of anger and the intensity of it will be personal and individual. And, you know, a thermometer. Sometimes we need to take a test of it. You know, are we just mildly irritated or annoyed when the driver cut us off? Are we going into a rage? And the number of road rage stories that some of the expressions of anger can be passive, you know, we're simmering under the surface, ready for to blow, or, you know, an active expression. Both are expressions of anger. And it would be impossible for everyone to experience anger in exactly the same way at every circumstance. So anger is a powerful emotion, Paul is saying, that can often lead to sin, but it isn't inherently sinful, okay? That's an important point. Now, then how should I respond? Well, I think the main thing that Paul says is put proper limits in place for righteous indignation. You see, there is, or in place for anger. There is no doubt a proper place for righteous indignation as we see in Jesus. But as F.F. Bruce, commentator, says, there is also the subtle temptation to regard my anger as righteous indignation and the other people's anger as sheer bad temper. Clearly, proper limits are required. Limits on what triggers it, on how we express it, how long we let it go on. We need to be clarifying and correcting our expectations. We had a refugee sponsorship meeting this week, and one of the things they said, you need to be aware of expectations. They said, you have expectations, and the refugees that will be coming have expectations. They may think the streets in Canada are paved with gold. Everybody has a job, everyone's wealthy, okay? So some expectations are unrealistic. And we may think, oh, they're going to be so happy and excited to finally be out of that war and conflict. And you may find they're grieving because they are deeply missing their family and the loss, and everything is so new. And so part of them may be celebrating and part of them may just be weeping and dealing with loss, expectations. And we think, why aren't they grateful? Or they may think, how come it's so difficult? Expectations. We need to, you know, have realistic expectations. We also have to have, of course, Paul says limits on how we express it. He will say, in terms of our words, let no unwholesome, no destructive words come out of your mouth. That is, things that tear down, but rather that which builds up. I want to also just show you a brief clip on from emotionally destructive marriages. Not going to work. Okay, it won't work. We're having the stories of hurt and healing, the insert that's in your bulletin. And so I was going to play you a short clip. Just comparing the difference, there's a difference between a difficult marriage. A difficult marriage, maybe you enter into and you thought, oh, there, I'm going to get the whole deck. You know, my spouse is going to love the things that I love. We're going to, you know, same friends, and we're going to be, you know, I'm an early riser, she's going to be an early riser, and then you get into your marriage and you realize, some of the cards are missing here, okay? That could be a difficult, you know, a disappointing marriage, a difficult marriage. We all have conflicts. You know, James says, we all stumble in many ways. If anyone doesn't stumble in what he says, he's perfect. We all stumble in many ways. We all have difficulties, but some of those challenges can be repetitive, they can be difficult, and we don't know how to handle them because they can't be solved so readily and easily. And then there can be destructive marriages where people regularly feel demeaned and dismissed and that they're just like part of the sideshow, and the person in the home, oh, they're central, superior, deserving, and everybody else needs to rotate and revolve around them. And so I just wanted to encourage you to come out to hear. It's also preventative. So if you are not familiar with what destructive relationships are really like and what it's like to live in that, we're going to have some stories and some teaching related to that. And I know just in the last year, it came to impact even within my own extended family, where police had to be called in a domestic dispute. This is stuff of real life, and we want to learn how to be able to work through that. What are the supports that God provides, including people to come along the way? Well, Paul also gives practical suggestions on how to limit or contain our anger by putting a time limit on it. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Now, if we were to go that literally, you know, we wouldn't have much time here most of the winter season, would we? We didn't see the sun today, dear. We don't have to worry about it. We can let that go. No. This saying was a proverb. It was common actually in Greek literature and Jewish literature from what we've been able to find as well. And it's saying that there are times when it is important and appropriate. Well, it's not saying this. But there is a time when it is appropriate to take a healthy time out. One of the things when you look into anger is that anger is actually an escalation of emotion over thinking. We actually literally get dumber the angrier we get. We do. It's our brain, the creative side of our brain that could help us problem solve and think of another approach to it, actually shuts down and as emotion escalates. And so a timeout. Science, psychologists, researchers tell us you need 10 minutes. At least 10 minutes usually if you've got really at the top of that thermometer before the brain begins to re-engage. So sometimes a timeout is what's needed to think a little more clearly, think about what you're saying and going to do, and then to re-engage. But the proverb, it's a guide. It's not a master. That is, you don't necessarily have to talk until all hours of the night. But you might say, we can't quite finish this. I know Elaine and I have had the occasional conflict on the way to church in the morning. We're probably the only family that has that. But I'll just give this advice just in case it ever happens to you. And sometimes it's like we're still haven't resolved this one when we're pulling into the parking lot. And I was like, I really have to go and do my job this morning. Don't have time to talk about it. And I've tried that. And then she's steaming, you know, the whole time. But if I say, this is important, we don't have time to finish this, can we finish this afternoon and go for a walk? Then we set a time and a place, and it's like, okay, I know I'm not being dismissed. I know that I can actually get to that, okay? See the difference? I tell you, it sure makes a difference. So, but the proverb is really telling us, don't let this simmer. It wisely warns us against brooding in anger or nursing a grudge. Deal with things properly, Paul's saying, and promptly, which is exactly what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. An additional motivation to keep one's anger from simmering or churning. Actually, there's a churning image in Proverbs. I just want to read the proverb. Proverb 30, verse 33, sir, it says, for as churning cream produces butter, and as twisting the nose produces blood, so stirring up anger produces strife. Proverbs 30, verse 33. When we hold grudges, Paul says, Satan gets a foothold. He gets a strategic advantage. He gets leverage. You know, been watching the basketball, and when they're looking for a rebound, you watch those guys. They want to make sure they get the inside spot for that rebound, right? And Paul is essentially saying, don't let Satan have the best spot there, the leverage to elbow you out and to use the conflict for his ends, especially when less effort and energy are required for a new problem to boil over when smaller problems have been simmering on the surface, right? If the water is already really warm, it doesn't take that much energy to get it to boiling. If it's cold, you know, you sit there and you wait for it to get. And then this can happen sometimes as it brews under the surface. Staph infection, this kind of staph infection. I heard that you like your associates to speak their mind. Is that true, Melonhead? A way of fighting more silent, the silent approach to anger. You know, staff relations show signs of strain when the other pastor's got the t-shirt on that says, I'm with stupid, and the arrow is pointing at the other fellow. Simmers under the surface, waiting to break out. I found a quote for many years, a quote by Aristotle, to be very helpful and wise. Aristotle said, anyone can become angry. Didn't take a wise man to say that. That is easy, he said. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, this is not easy. Amen? It's kind of a checklist for us. I think a practical checklist. And Paul says, in your anger, do not sin. Check. Check these things over. You know, because what often happens in counseling, we call it the rubber band effect. Maybe you're in the midst of something arises, you know, I didn't put the dishes away or in the dishwasher. I just put them on the sink and I thought they were self-cleaning. And then there's kind of an irritable response that is bigger than just a one-time not having put the dishes away. You know, it's like this is the 20th time this week, right? There's this intensity because the intensity that is coming at you is stretching back, not just from this one moment, but from all of these other unresolved moments, right? And then this big wham, and you get this intensity that breaks out. It's usually indicative that this has been brewing. Something has been brewing for a while underneath the surface. And so it's an indicator we need to talk about the issue or the issues, the larger issue. And so when I've done anger management classes in the past, if you can put up the next slide, we talk about what are the triggers, the things that stimulate, and we look at some of those. And sometimes we just say, well, you know, my genetic programming prevents me from stopping to ask for directions, you know? And it's like, well, then let's unprogram that. Let's create some space, difference between how, you know, what the trigger is and the response so that you can have a proper response. And God does this with Cain in Genesis chapter 4. It's a textbook case. Cain is angry and God comes to him and essentially unpacks, why are you angry? And what do you want? Not just, I want to be better than my brother. Like, that's the immediate. But think deeper than that. What do you really want? You want acceptance with God, God is saying to him. That's what you really want. So knowing that, how then can I achieve my goal? That is the deeper, better goal. Because in conflict, we need to recognize that the bottom line for the Christian is never, how can I get my own way? But how will the Lord be honored? Will he be honored also in how I respond? And now, knowing that, if you do what is right, God said to Cain, will you not also be accepted? Acceptance was the deeper issue, but he didn't let himself go there. He just thought, I'm hurting. I want my brother to feel the hurt that I'm feeling, and the quickest way is to eliminate him. And then, destruction. When we forget that it's the Lord's way that needs to be honored, then we become destructive, and the road to reconciliation grows longer and more difficult. It can even become impossible, humanly speaking. So, plan for constructive conflict. For example, decide when and where to meet. It can seem pretty simple and straightforward, but it's rather than just letting it go on forever. Can we decide that we need to talk about something? Can we clarify what the issue or concern is that I wish to discuss? Not these 15 things, but this one, at least beginning with this one. State what is bothering you and how it impacted you or how it is impacting you. You know, when you said such and such, I felt belittled. You know, I could go on, I won't. But using I instead of, I hate it when you do that to me. You know, try to own it. I language we talk about, it really is important because it's owning it's observing what you observed and then how it's impacting. How is it impacting you? And ask for feedback to make sure that you're understood. Last week, somebody who talked about a good resource talked about in communication, both listening and speaking, you know, there's these things called filters that are in there, filtering out what I'm hearing because I'm listening through my experience or my culture or my worldview. And so we need to check, is the message that I'm sending, how's that being received so that we can work and collaborate together on that? Because, and that can also, if you just go back for a moment, and what am I expecting? What am I hoping for? Sometimes I'm just angry. I haven't really thought out, well, what would I actually like to change? And that can be a challenge to say, well, actually what I'm hoping for is an apology. I know it can't be undone, but just to recognize that I was hurt by that. And to hear you say, I'm sorry you were hurt by that. I want to try to prevent that from happening in the future. That makes a world of difference. Can't replace some things, but we can try to clarify our expectations and invite a response. Sometimes solutions, we're going to look at conflict resolution. We're going to look at forgiveness next week in the story of Joseph. God tells long stories, and sometimes we need to take one stage at a time in the journey. And sometimes we need to say, well, can we just try doing something different. Can we try you at least putting those dishes away on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday? Like, okay, well, I can try that. And then let's visit at the end of the week and see how that's going. Maybe we can add in Thursday as well and Tuesday, and it'll be a habit forming. And you might, with a plan of follow-up meeting. I want to just give a few moments. Perhaps you have questions or insights that you would like to offer to what I've said about planning for constructive conflict. Yes. So what Julie was saying, just to repeat this, that it's often helpful. We sometimes fill in things with assumptions, and if we're not asking people kind of questions to check our assumptions with that, because we may assume a certain intent behind a behavior that wasn't really their intent, but we assume that, and so we don't actually get to understanding why that happened, and that can impact. Is that helpful enough? Yes, Hollis. Hey, excellent. Thank you, Hollis. So Hollis just shared a story, but just his dad had somebody that came across yelling and just ramped up, it sounded like, you know, with the aggression, and just praying and saying, God, give me the patience for this and help for the appropriate response. That is tapping into a whole new resource that Paul is talking about now that God is working at recreating us in his image. Thank you for that. Yes, Rosella. Thank you, Rosella. Rosella said, God has to be in the center. And if we remember that, that will help us. Because then we are recognizing he's the ultimate authority. I'm not trying to take over God's place in this. Very important. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes. Very much so. So conflict is a healthy part of life. If we aren't having conflict, how are our kids going to learn how to deal with conflict and how not to deal with conflict? Right? So it's important that that's a part of, and a part of, especially with teenagers, how are they going to learn what their own values and how those express themselves on different issues if they don't have a safe place to practice and say, Dad, I totally disagree, you know, and how do you respond to that? Anyone else? Sorry, someone over there. Yes, Jeremy. Yes. So Jeremy is asking, so sometimes people get together to protest something, and what would be a constructive protest? And I think when we see that there is a place that protest can point out, here is an issue that needs to be addressed, okay? And sometimes what happens is when we see when anger or violence or even the war of words erupts, that it sidetracks from what the real issue is and how the behavior becomes the main issue. And so protest has been used. I would say Jesus also did forms of protest. Protesting changes. Of course, the one in the temple was the most expressive, but also a different boundary line about different accepting of people. That was a form of protest and modeling a different way. Well, I want to keep you here all morning, but appreciate the opportunity for live talk back this morning. And let's just take a moment to pray.